Hello and welcome to Scoppy Radio. My name is Daniel Johansson, and we are without Maureen Smith today. She had to work at... Oh my god. Nice, Gabe. Nailed it. First time on the show.
Love you, Maureen.
Yeah.
Definitely return guest.
No, so we're actually up at 8. Well, we didn't get started until 8:30 because I'm a monster and bad at mornings. But Maureen had to work at 6, and I'm in this production of Boheme with a few guys. So long-time listeners of the show that, like, we've had a lot of, like, not trans guests, but we've talked a lot about trans issues and, like, women's issues, and, like, we've had a ton of women on. This show is the Four Dudes show, and, like, it's going to be fun. It's going to be really great, but if you're, like, not about that, listen to last week's. Last week's was fantastic. This is going to be a different thing. So I'm really excited about it. Dan Granbaugh is here again, second time on the podcast.
Yeah, here.
Joaquin Lewis, longtime listener, first time show member, which I'm very excited to have you on.
Hello.
And then Gabe DiGennaro. Did I say it wrong?
No, you had little spiels about both of them.
Yeah.
Just like, Gabe.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of the plethora of picked. I can't pick from the plethora of good things to say about you is the thing.
I'm honored. Thanks,
yeah, man. I don't want to seem shave. Like too like excited to have you on. So I'm just like, and Gabe.
Yeah, no. Some desperation.
Yeah. This is pumped for the show, by the way. We should keep this too. Like,
yeah. Right. I'm psyched to be here.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. So we are all in Boheme. Dan is singing Marcello, Joaquim's singing Rodolfo, you're singing Schaunard, and I'm doing the Colline. And it's cool, too, because we did this show last year with Approuvé. Is that how it's pronounced?
There.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, it's fun because I feel like the four of us especially have done a lot of different, like, storefront opera throughout Chicago in a lot of different forms. So getting to see that kind of all culminate into this, like, really ensemble-y, like, product is really interesting. What have your guys' experience been like coming back to it after last year?
Yeah, we obviously get along pretty well on stage as well as off stage. But the most challenging thing I found is not doing the same exact thing that we did last year.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Which Miss Cox and Miss O'Shaughnessy.
I think it's O'Shag Hennessy.
They both been very, very
O'Shag Hennessy.
It's already the boys edition.
That's not mine, that's Key. That's Key and Peele. I'm quoting Key and Peele show.
Yeah.
So they've both been incredibly
Aaron.
Coming at it from a different angle, which is keeping us fresh for sure. They're not letting us just go like, oh, well, last year we did this. And it's almost, I almost felt bad saying that, like, oh, this is great. Last year we did this and last year we did that. It's like, oh no, this is our own unique, beautiful thing. Don't let us ruin it for you.
It is kind of hard though, being in the same space though, because it's so small. You know, like being in that same space and being like, this worked last time and this did not. It's kind of, I think, where I'm coming from in the rehearsal process. But I think it's great having like two fresh creative minds on the team, because that adds so much more to, in like a, I don't want to say an old production, but like, you know, a production,
right?
You know, new voices and new like opinions.
Because all the Adolphe or Alcindoro, Benoit is new, as well as the Mimi and the
Musette.
And then conductor and director, like we were talking about. But do you know should we talk about how we ended up back there? Like,
I'll be honest. As soon as Brenda Turner started posting about needing that, she was auditioning, I was like, listen, I don't know if you're planning on recasting this, but I had such a blast last year. I would love to do it again. Like, please consider me.
Yeah.
Like, I would love to do it.
I had a really similar situation. I was like, hey, this was a kick-ass opportunity. I would love to give it to somebody else, but if you want me back, I would love to do it again.
Right. Like, I know there's not a lot of little voices. Like, I know, like, you probably got, like, two dudes, and they're probably like, okay. Like, like, I'm here.
As backup.
Yeah.
Same thing as Gabe. I said, I don't know if you want me back this year, but if I could do Adolfo once a year,
right,
I will come back and do Rodolfo once a year just to have that in, have that as part of me, as my annual thing. And Brenda said, okay. And I had a shot to do a show in San Francisco, Opera and Tap San Francisco. I actually offered a Clemenza di Tito when I went home randomly to sing in their show in October. Mm-hmm. And but they asked me to come home for like 6 weeks. And I was just like, I just got a new job. I can't, I can't tell my new job. And then and I had kind of put in my consideration with Opera Rivera, and it came down between the two, and I just couldn't. It would have been my first lead role in San Francisco, which is awesome, my hometown, but I was like, but it's Bohème, and if I don't, if I have to turn that down, which I'd be disappointed, it's still Bohème. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was just like...
And it's such a unique Bohème, too.
Definitely.
Right? Because it's the fact that it's a three-course meal during the show, in that mm-hmm. such a unique space. And it went over super well last year.
Oh, like, sold out.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think that Bohème could be presented in a more kind of authentic, kind of gritty way than mm-hmm. at a coffee bar in
Pittsburgh. Right. Unless they just served everybody salted herrings. For four people. Hey, one salted herring so you can get the feel of it. And then we're going to put water in a wine bottle and pretend it's wine. We'll give you a little drop of pink food color.
Yeah,
and pretend,
you know? Yeah, and you'll have to pretend that, that you've got a call from the king. Or like. Yeah.
And Dan was the only one who re-auditioned, actually, right?
No, I didn't. I didn't re-audition. So I told
no. Let's get this straight. No.
I talked to Brenda like last year when we did the show, and I was like, anytime you do this show, I love this show. I'll do any role in this show.
Literally, because you have done. I've done everybody
but Rodolfo. But I'm going towards tenor these days. So.
Yeah, but you sing my notes sometimes.
Like, yeah, I steal those high G's.
Want to be Rodolfo.
Yeah.
No, I didn't mean honestly. Feminist message for this show: that men are interchangeable. Like we are worthless and like can be fit into any role.
Sorry. Go ahead. But I told her basically.
Expendable. That's what it was.
I told her I'd come back, and then I was so distracted with like, you know, War and Peace and like all the other projects that like I like totally forgot about the audition call. Just completely forgot about it. And then Brenda's like, so, Marcello? And then it was literally a one sentence, like, ask, one sentence response. I'd be like, yes, I'll do it. And, like, and then we got into rehearsal and we're just like, oh yeah, it's a lot of Italian. So it's,
maybe it was at the point that all three of us had already signed on and she was like, well, it'd be weird if one of the dudes was...
I know, maybe, yeah.
Yeah.
So you're welcome, Dan.
But I did mention that I was interested to her, so I mean...
Oh, yeah.
So it was more of an...
The cool thing is that we all said, hey, you're doing it again. I'd love to come back, but wouldn't you... I don't know if you want new people. I don't want new people, and I didn't want to take it away from somebody who really wants... As much as I want to do the role, that's what I told her. I said, did you not want a new cast? She goes, I'm up to the old cast if they're what I choose, or a new cast. Yeah, but yeah. I'd like that option. And I was like, okay.
Yeah. We're just really nice guys. Trying to get it to somebody
I think
else.
It's just because actually I think it's because we're super handsome.
That's what it is.
I mean, I guess
they
sing
hear
too
it on this mic.
Yeah,
can't you hear that we're super handsome?
Is that what
now
we're,
they can?
That's why we recorded in the morning.
Yeah. That's why we recorded in the morning.
So we have the low.
So even the tenor has a low voice this morning.
Lower than me. Should I be concerned?
Well, yeah, no, and I think it's. I forgot what I was going to say already.
I'm sorry.
Well, I think it's interesting that it's the four guys because I like. That are repeat, because for some reason I feel like that I almost feel like it's just part of the scenery, the like the dudes, you know, like
people come in and out of their lives throughout
yeah,
the show,
yeah,
like the Mimi and the Musa,
yeah, and so it's kind of an interesting, like, I don't know, I'm like glad for that, weirdly. I don't know,
just like the only thing Benoit is the only one who comes back. I mean, like,
yeah.
A weird anchor point in the show,
yeah. Right. I don't know. I also thought it was cool too that we're sorry. I also thought it was cool that we were opening up some of the cuts again too.
Mm. Yeah.
I have to say that I was like,
yeah,
because I kind of breezed through them the first time. Because for those who don't know, we were doing a baby Bohème, so there's no chorus, there's mm-hmm. no Compromario parts. So there's a decent amount of.
I kind of want to sing Prugna di Tor, though. I just
I know, every time it comes up, I'm like, Prugna di Tor.
So, act one's complete.
I mean, Parpignol still is, like, in my head.
Right.
Even though we cut, like... Yeah.
So, mostly, the cuts are mostly in act what? Two and...
Act two.
And
act,
three.
I think
act
just... Three, oh,
in
I
the
don't
beginning
know.
Of act three with the hopla, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So, so there's no Compromario. What was I going to say?
Something about the cuts.
Oh, right, the cuts. And so, I breezed through the second email that Kathy... sent us, and like, oh, these are the cuts. I was like, oh, they look similar to what we did last year. I, like a week before this, we started rehearsals, I looked through them more specifically. I was like, damn it. Yeah. I have to learn like 4 more lines in Italian.
Yeah.
That's the hardest. Like, learning a whole chunk of a role is easy, but then it's like those last couple lines that you're trying to stick into your head.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what the chicken line always looks like. That's
what's chicken is a poem.
The most embarrassing thing for me as a performer is that it was the last line I learned last year. And so when we came back to it, Gabe was like, sorry, podcast gold. I'm like, Gabe made this face of just like, you better know it this time. And then the first rehearsal came, the line came, and I was like,
And he goes, you missed it. He goes, was that the fucking chicken line again?
But that's why you're such a great Colleen. It's like, it's like you're just like, fuck it. Like, I don't care. Like, I don't, like, it's all right.
Yeah, they made the comparison to Kramer this year from
Seinfeld.
Just so dead on.
Yeah.
Just totally out of it, but always there.
Yeah, no, I love Colleen because it fits me really well. It's like really easy to do, especially because this year we're doing this like stoner angle. And so the entire idea that like he doesn't pay attention really makes sense to me and is really easy for me to do because it's so like I don't pay attention. I don't have like ADD or anything like that, but I'd like would much rather like be in a corner with my own brain than like not that I don't like love listening to other people and love listening to other people's, but like I don't know. I have that like introverted. Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that poet, that philosopher kind of mentality.
Yeah, and so it's really easy to do that.
Do you guys feel the same connections to your
characters? I think Marcello is kind of an asshole. I mean, like it's really hard for me to. Well, first of all, like I mean, like being the other characters, analyzing Marcello and then being Marcello is really interesting because you look at the character as like someone that's judging the shit out of the other character, and then you become that character. So it's hard not to carry that in there. Mm-hmm. But I just feel like he's I was talking to Kim about this yesterday, but I feel like, you know, like Rodolfo and Marcello, like they're just such liars. You know, they're like, I mean, people argue about Bohème being like, you know, the death of innocence, right?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Like that's like the big, like, you know, at the end, innocence is dead and youth is dead and like you have to grow up all at once.
Yeah.
But there's like, I don't know, like Marcello is like lying to himself about Musetta the whole time, mm-hmm. is lying to his friend for most of Act 3 and is like lying to everybody essentially, mm-hmm. and like not communicating with Colline, insulting him in Act 1.
We barely have any.
We don't really talk, even though we're the two people that make all the money.
Yeah.
Like
yeah, I tell you to give me the goblet that one time, and that's about it.
Yeah. And I'm like bossing you around. His lines don't make him like a person that I really like.
Yeah.
But his music is great. So like it makes you think he's a great, you know, soul or person or all these things.
Mm. Well, almost in his own head.
Yeah.
Well, we catch Marcello in a really, like, weird snapshot of his life, though, because he's just in this on-and-off relationship, and it's mostly off. Like, he's mostly been broken up with recently.
Right.
And so, like, we're catching him, like, I don't know about you guys, but, like, that's some of the worst times of my life. And not, I don't mean, like, worse, like, oh, I had such a hard time. I'm saying, like, I was a terrible person. Mm. I remember having been recently broken up with and just being, like, a fucking shitty person to people. I don't know if that's true for you guys too, but I just think it's interesting that that's when we see Marcello and his most like aggressive, not aggressive, but like his most active performance is when he's watching his ex-girlfriend like be with another man. And on top of that, it's fucking Alcindoro, which like, what is that even? I don't know. I think it's.
I always think he's the guy in Act 1. Like, Alcindoro is the guy in Act 1 that you're imitating.
The English guy.
So, I always love to hear it with that English accent. Like, you know, like when he comes in, he's like, no, Musetta. Tito. If it's like, it got that edge to it, it kind of feels like it's connected in the same neighborhood, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Well, how about Rodolfo for you?
I think that. That idea of the Bohemian has been speaks to me because I've been living it basically ever since I moved here to Chicago 10 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, I really, maybe there have been a couple of times when I felt comfortably financially, whereas, as opposed to living paycheck to paycheck or like scraping by or, you know, and or going to the bank of mom and dad and go, can you like spot me $100 to just to cover the rest of my rent? Mm. You know, and that's kind of what it is. And so like, and so to hear these things like, you know, being 5 years out of grad school and going, wow, all I really can eat is ramen this week and maybe buy spaghetti and a cheap can of Hunt's tomato sauce. Yeah. It's just like, wow, like I'm like 5 years out of grad school and I'm still, this is still happening because I'm deciding to be a singer.
I'm choosing to be a singer.
Yeah. I'm choosing to be an artist as opposed to sitting in front of a computer. And I, you know, humble brag, I have all the job experience. I can have office experience, retail experience, but I don't want to do that. I just sitting in front of a computer, lets me get my emailing done. And all the small tedious work. When I was running an opera company, I got all the emails done. I got to do flyers and things to mess around with, but I was just like, oh, there's still 6 hours left, you know? It's just like, oh, whereas, it's kind of crazy. It's living on the edge. But I'd rather go do this. I'd rather go and sing. And if I'm making $100 after a 4 week production run, but it meant all of my nights were taken up with rehearsals, but I'm rehearsing Bohème and I'm rehearsing Puccini.
Right.
I'd rather do that than perhaps make $100 or more every night at the restaurant where I work.
Yeah, and that's
like, sorry, go ahead.
And that's what I think is so cool about you being Rodolfo, right? Because you do live very passionately, like knowing you as a person, you are like a living romantic in a lot of ways. And I think that like, sorry,
go on.
Four guys in a room talking about being romantic. No, we've got so Rodolfo in my mind is like the true artist, and Marcello is like trying to be an artist, right? Because like he's like painting on the side of buildings and like he's like creating artwork and protective of it, but like Rodolfo burns his play in the very beginning and like is like spitting out poetry like constantly.
Living his craft.
And he's like living it, and he's like a really like passionate person like in every part of what he's doing. Marcello is like protecting his piece of artwork and protecting like the side of a building that he's just like painting on for money that just means nothing. And like I don't know, it's just different types of artists, I guess.
It'd be a good point to bring up privilege right now, I think, too. The fact that we can have the choice to live these lives and make the choice to live paycheck to paycheck, have a mom and dad bank. I don't want to speak for all of us.
Yeah, right.
But have that kind of safety net, pseudo safety net of sorts, while we're pursuing this bohemian quote.
Like they couldn't pull back, like when the characters that Puccini's trying to portray, not that necessarily this is the greater point about privilege to make, but comparing like our lives today to their lives then, like they couldn't make the phone call. You know what
or
I mean?
Or even other artists today.
No,
there
that's
are plenty of
the
kids
much
who
better privilege. Yeah,
with thousands and thousands.
Well, that's actually a good segue into the idea of who we're basing the show.
Emma Cotton.
Can I just add on? Yeah, this is the boys' show. This whole production's run by women.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's pretty cool to have Emma coming from the point of view of a woman. She goes, okay, dude, Rodolfo, seriously, you're maybe 21. You've probably had some flings. You've never loved a girl. And this girl comes in, and you're totally checking her out, dude. Come on.
Right.
And I was like,
yeah.
It takes Emma to bring out the bro in us.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Emma was very inspired by the ghost ship tragedy.
In San Francisco?
In Oakland. California.
Oakland.
Yeah.
Where
it's right next to my home. My mother's from Oakland. Shout out to Oakland.
Hey.
And, it was a collective, if you want to say, of artists in this big warehouse that had no safety regulations, had no fire regulations, had no nothing. This man owned it, and he was taking rent from a bunch of artists who basically put up a string and a curtain. And
it wasn't like $100 a month. It was like
$600-$700. Yeah.
It was a lot, yeah.
And they were just giving themselves rooms by like putting up a curtain and a string across the ceiling.
Yeah.
But they got to practice their art there. There were all kinds of artists there from age ranges of like teenager to like 40s. Like, yeah.
40, 50 year olds.
Yeah. And
everything from music to visual art DJing to any type of art.
Any type of art.
True Renaissance.
Yeah. And they got, and that was their chance. They got to produce their own art. They had a place, had a wide open space. And then unfortunately one night they had a big party and a fire started. And I think from what I read, there was only one exit. There was only one available. And it was on the second floor.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And 30 plus, I think maybe about 33 people lost their lives. And it was a huge hit to the artist community because all kinds of artists showed up. It's not just opera singer. It was a singer and it was a musician, visual artist. They had all people coming into that house and it was a big, big thing. And so Emma was really inspired by this and she decided that we would dedicate this and kind of base our production on that idea where we were basically kind of just trying to, basically how it in Rudolph Azaria, how do I live? If we're just, we just live. That's I can't tell you that, you know, I write, but I kind of just live.
Yeah,
and then that's kind of a cool thing to talk about.
She talked about maybe having us portray them on stage, but also acknowledging that that'd be like super weird if she saw her brother, who just passed away, being portrayed on stage. So instead, we're each picking an artist who died in the fire, and kind of putting up their picture and a little bit of bio on the wall, and kind of just honoring them with our performance instead of
donning like them,
physically portraying them. But yeah, it brought up across the United States just issues with artists' housing and safety codes and buildings like that, because that's not a unique situation. I mean, the fire, yes, but that living situation,
right? Yeah, there's like places like all over the country that
all over the world. Yeah. But
yeah,
it makes the heaviness of Bohème even heavier. It's palpable. It's current.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, the ending of Bohème, what do you think happens, after?
Right?
That's always, the question I always ask. It's like, you know, like, where do these people go afterwards? Like, do they give up?
Well, even the base level of, like, do they stay in contact, or do they...
Does this rip them apart?
Yeah. And I thought Emma made a good point where tragedy like that usually brings people closer together, which I think is really powerful. And I don't know what their living situation is like by the end of it, but because it is just kind of a snapshot into their lives, like that fourth act.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know who's living with who and who's got more money and who doesn't. It seems like they're all fucking broke. So I can only imagine when you're that poor, you don't have the option to leave, you know, you
where
can't
else are you gonna go?
So
Musetta probably has
absolutely.
She's selling these.
I seem pretty consistent with bringing in some money. It seems like I have the most applicable job as a musician, either playing for people or killing animals with my music.
Right. Yeah.
but both acts, I'm always the one coming in. Actually, here's all the food that I got with all the money that I made. And I mean, As a house painter, I guess your art can be applicable in some.
Well, I mean, we're updating some of this stuff, so it's I was thinking, with Act 3, because we're setting Act 3 in the Garay, so we're setting it in the actual apartment, which makes me think maybe I'm doing graphic design for some bullshit job, or something along those lines, just building the house essentially, or painting the house, you know. But there's elements of each job that I think you can modernize. I mean,
of course.
Maybe you're playing a wedding band or
a church job.
Church job, right? Yeah.
No, I think the lifestyles are definitely translatable, between different generations, if you want to call it that.
But yeah, I think, I don't know, I think it'd be, with how passionate Rodolfo is, I mean, he's the one who's affected most, obviously, by this. He still this probably brings you and Musetta together even closer.
Well, that's what I was going to say, because I feel like the four men...
she gets consumption, then she dies... And then
that's true. Yeah.
Oh, that's true.
Yeah. No. I think the four guys definitely wouldn't have a reason to come apart. My curiosity is, do you think that Musetta and Rodolfo, Musetta and Marcello stay together at that point, or do you think that's the last straw, or do you think
I don't know. Maybe it's because I just got a puppy.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about responsibility and
Well, no, I want to get part of it.
But I mean, the moment where Marcello and Musetta leave together to go get medicine and something to take care of her.
Yeah.
And she does a prayer and there's all these moments and Marcello is really just shut up at this point. He's he doesn't say much. And I think that he talks a whole lot in Act 3 and a whole lot in Act 2. And there's this progression of anger in his character that gets completely quelled by a death. you know, and I think that he realizes...
It brings him out of himself, right?
Brings him out of himself, where he has to, like, rely on other people and, like, you know, have someone else there to help. And I think that he doesn't really do that well with Rodolfo. They're both very independent. I think that he's very much on an island for the rest of the guys, too. And I think that's the moment where he finally realizes, like, you know, he needs someone else to help him through, like, tough times.
Right. And I personally believe that the relationship between Marcello and Musetta is so difficult from Marcello's end. Because, like, I think Musetta most of the time is like, well, are you going to marry me or not? Like, like, I just always flash to, like, the single ladies. Like,
right.
Or just, like, put a ring on it or get the fuck out. And so I feel like after seeing his best friend's girlfriend, if you want to call it that, die, like...
Kind of like a wake-up call.
Yeah.
Hopefully in a healthy way, not like in a...
Like,
but also, I'm so emotional about you. Let's make this work. And like a month later, be like,
But we're not doing this in this production. But part of me just like thinks that, like, you know, he's interested in other women.
Yeah.
Just like she's interested in other guys, and I think that like there's that moment where he's like talking to me for a long time alone, lying to Rodolfo in Act 3. And it's like there's that extended period of time we were talking about. Like it's like 10-15 pages. It's like. Like a very significant part of the score in Act 3 where he's lying to Rodolfo about hiding his girlfriend and having a private conversation.
Yeah.
I mean, which could be like he's trying to expose things in his friend and be really clever, but I don't think Marcello's that smart. You know, like...
Yeah. No, that's very true.
It seems a little dirty and kind of sketchy, and it's like... Yeah. It's hard... I don't know. I talked to other people about Bohème, and some people just hate the guys in Bohème, except for like Colleen and Schoenaerts.
It's one of the most forgettable Puccini baritones. Marcello.
Yeah.
But
he's singing high the whole time.
He definitely is a Puccini baritone, but like compared to Tosca and that's the only other Puccini that I can think of right now.
Sharpless.
Really? I always remember Sharpless. Well, because he's so representative of America in Butterfly.
True, but I guess it's the more the aria kind of. I just memorizing like tunes.
But then again, Sharpless is sketchy too, man. he's like looking out for his tenor, you know, like the whole time.
Just watching him just be like totally.
Yeah, and you know, then
colonize this woman
and Scarpia. Yeah. I mean, like Scarpia's such an asshole.
Yeah. Scarpia's terrible, but like openly terrible. I think that's what I love about that role is that you don't see the like just a bad dude. Very often, you know, like...
But with Marcello, you hear the beautiful music, and you hear, like, the artistry, and you hear all those things in the music, where you're just like, this guy's okay! But then you, like, look at the text, and you're just like, maybe not that okay!
Yeah!
Like, you know, like... yeah! And you see it just kind of running, it's like a train that's, like, running into a wall, and then by Act 4, he, like, compliments Musetta, and is, like, has a genuine moment, and, like, that's the change that, like, that's really cool to see for... For me, is like, you know, now doing it for my second time, to like see that there's these moments where you really need to play him like a jerk.
And in order to make the ending more...
effective.
Yeah, for sure.
Because otherwise, you're just cheating the moment. Like, the moment needs to be big at the end for a lot of people more than me.
Right.
You know?
Right. And that's even thinking of Michel and Il Tabarro and Skeeky.
Oh, yeah.
Like, those are the other big...
But I mean, even Skeeky's a jerk too, man. Yeah. Like, he like pushes an old dead guy out.
It's an interesting thing to think about it all as a play on morality, because like in a lot of different ways, like
Bohème or just Puccini baritones.
Characters in general, and I think that Puccini baritones are a really interesting like subset or like selection of like a study of them, because you have Marcello, where I don't think he's inherently evil. At all. I think that he is the most relatable of like a character doing something wrong, because like
I'd say selfish.
Yeah. And like
human.
Who is human. Yeah.
Yeah. Whereas like talking, going back to Tosca, Scarpia, that's not relatable. Like, that's a bad guy. Oh, it's
not relatable.
Yeah, he's just like...
To you guys?
Well, yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it's interesting, okay, too, because Scarpia was all wrapped up in the Napoleon side of the, like, revolution.
It brings it to a less human level in the fact that it's political, in the fact that it's militaristic. Because, right. Like, but obviously, that's still human. That's still present in our world today.
Yeah.
But it's less relatable to the person going to see the opera, mm-hmm, than Marcello, because that's just, like, a normal day-to-day human as opposed to somebody in, yeah, a very high position of power.
Yeah, and even Sharpless, like... similar thing where, like, he's more representative of that political militaristic mindset, but from America. Like, he and fucking, what's the tenor's name?
Pinkerton.
Yeah. Are the, Pinkerton, like, dual sides of the American imperial mindset, which is really interesting.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead, and I feel like I cut you off at some point.
No, I'm still just wanting to talk about my character.
Yeah. I think, in all of that, Marcello's sins are the most forgivable to me.
Yeah. I think, you know, part of me that the audience doesn't catch, like, you know, sometimes when, like, it's not performed in a way that's, like, accessible, I hate the word accessible, but, like, you know, like...
Yeah. No, but it's a good word. It's hard, there aren't a lot of... Sorry, go ahead, yeah.
But the act two, like, you know, like, Mimi comes in with Rodolfo and is like, hey, found my muse. And, like, they start rhyming this, like, awesome poetry. Like, and gross. Colline and Schaunard are rhyming along with them. And what does Marcello do? But he's just like, oh, this is bullshit. he flips out and, like, ruins it. And then they have to do this toast to try to make it better. And, like, before Musetta even comes in.
Yeah.
So that's like...
That's true. You're a jerk even before the female...
I know.
Yeah.
I mean, those are things that, like, you know, come out to me when I'm looking at the character, but it's like, that kind of tells something about the four of us, that, like, we have this, like, you guys are the happy people that are trying to keep things good, and she's, like, the super passionate person in, like, this positive way, and I'm just the super passionate person in this negative way.
Yeah. All sides of the coin. And I think that's why Puccini can have four... dude roles and not be repetitive. Like, there are things that make us similar in ways, but there is so much that,
well, they're fleshed out, and they all come from, I don't know how much you guys know about, like, the Commedia tradition, all really come from there. And I mean, they're not direct, they're extremely derivative,
like Inarata,
but that's the thing, is that they're all uniquely fleshed out characters. And it's so cool, because talking about accessibility, I'd love to actually talk more about the concept of accessibility too, because it's such a... Let me finish my point first. Sorry.
Marcello judging away over there.
Yeah, no.
What the fuck, man?
Standard Daniel move, though. It's like setting up three tangents to go on and then forgetting all three tangents. Fuck, what was the first thing I was talking about?
Accessibility?
Well, before, no, what got me into it?
Commedia.
Yeah, but...
was there one before that?
No, there was something in between that I was... The point that I was really trying to make about accessibility... I don't know, it'll come back. Let's do the accessibility conversation. Because I think...
Podcast.
Yeah, I know. The thing that's interesting to me about accessibility is that, yes, like, it is such a... Like, you get into these non-profit... storefront opera companies, new opera companies in general, any opera company that's not the Lyric or it's not the Met is always talking about accessibility, and I think even to some extent the Lyric or the Met is,
because of companies like the
exactly.
I feel like that conversation wouldn't have started unless there was that
grassroots
moves. I mean, you had that whole entire session with Anthony Freud.
Yeah. Well, we talked about accessibility a lot there too, but I've had conversations about that since then. And I just think that, like, if you can find me a list of 10 organizations, like, that are opera organizations that don't include accessibility in their mission or vision statement, just the word accessibility, just send them my way. I want to see those companies, because they're thinking, like, more creatively about how to say it, you know? Like,
well, that's an interesting thing, because when you actually take down the word accessibility and, like, pick it apart and, like, try and figure out what people are actually trying to say, it's that we need more diverse audiences, we need to be reaching out to more communities, and we need to, like, make these plots more relevant.
Yeah,
and those are all different things. Sorry, no, what were you gonna
say? By saying that, you've already piqued my interest a lot more than just, like, saying
buzzwords,
we're accessible.
Buzzwords. Yeah. Right.
You know, like, those three things, by you just saying that, I'm immediately more interested in what you're about to say. You know,
like, well, and I think the thing is, though, is that that's the shame, is because that's what accessibility is supposed to be. And so as soon as a company touts itself as accessible, but then is, like, not reaching out to underprivileged communities, it's like, what the fuck are you trying to do then, besides make a quick buck?
Accessible to that other banker that needs to give us $1 million.
I mean, you need to fund your productions, but I mean, if you're gonna say accessible, like, you define that,
right?
And you don't just use it as a catch-all. Everyone's using it as a catch-all.
Yeah.
There was a really recent interview with a general manager who's just retiring, and there's that really controversial comment about African American audiences. Did you hear about that?
Yeah. Mm. Was SF Symphony?
Was it?
I was pulling this up right now. He said they're taking a little quote of it. It said, "Quote: We never had a relationship with the African American community."
Yeah.
And he goes, and something like,
not having the resources or the
we don't
time,
have the resources or the energy or whatever it is to slot ourselves into a logical relationship with the African American community, a relationship built on the kind of cultural tradition we have in other communities. If you don't have that connection, then the effort feels forced. It feels artificial. And then I think you're worse off than if you didn't do anything at all.
It's hard to swallow that, but there is truth underneath some of those really poorly chosen words. The fact that it does take energy, it does take resources.
Well, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not easy.
No, I mean, like, yeah, but not... yeah, don't not try then.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, because I understand that it can come off force, where it's just like, let's just do an opera with all black people, and then black people will come to see it.
That's the thing we've talked about a couple times when talking about intersectionality, because it is such a thorny, tricky thing to handle, because it can become so quickly tokenism.
Mm-hmm.
And you just like, we're like, oh, we need a black person, and they need to be the black person, and they need to do black people things, and they need to like... look like a black person and act like a black person. And that's terrible. That's the problem. But, like, all you have to do is recognize that that's the problem. And then that's, like, yeah, it's hard. But, like, it's hard in the way of, like, just understanding culture enough to, like, be like, okay, this is not... Like, all you really need to do is cast black people in white roles. Or, like, do derived work that involves... people of different cultures, like, which, it's this game of like
Yardbird, right?
Yeah,
and
but I mean, you could even trace that back to, I mean, Duke Ellington's opera, which is Queenie Pie,
which was before then.
You know?
Yeah,
because Lawrence Brown Lee is continuing his work. There, I think he's looking into getting another jazz opera going with Philadelphia Opera Company. I think,
mm-hmm. Yeah, or whatever. I mean, there's some people doing progressive things like in the opera community now. I'm just thinking that. That a lot of people don't really take the time to define the word accessibility. And like, when people say, oh, it's, you know, accessible or like all these different things, they're just literally just trying to blanket over with one word everything that we need to be getting really gritty about.
Yeah.
And that's...
cushioning it instead of actually getting...
Yeah, and I think that this poem is totally the definition of accessibility.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean... Yeah. We are reaching an area that doesn't get a lot of opera. We're doing something that is like right in front of you. We're translating it in a way like with the performances that we're giving that like makes you really understand the story about an issue that's still relevant.
Yeah.
I'd be interested in us seeing us do like a $20 ticket night for like lower income people
without
potentially
the dinner or something like that.
Yeah, and I have no problem like openly saying that, because like I like, although like the dinners and all the whole experience of it is really something, I do know there are a lot of people that would come but can't afford it.
Right. The tickets are $50 and it comes with a 3-course meal and the performance. And
yeah,
if you break that down to like a normal night, like that's still a great deal. But overall,
yeah,
like,
$50 isn't a normal night for everybody.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So having
yeah, and
that'd
that's
be really interesting to have like more of a opening up or dress rehearsal,
right?
Something like that to be.
Yeah, and I don't think that I don't think it's a game of like not having the one and then having the other. Just in the conversation of accessibility, right? In the conversation of elitist, if
not,
you want to call it that,
opera.
Not saying that I'm so sorry. I should clarify. I'm no longer talking about the ticket pricing. I'm just talking about generally the conversation we're having.
Gotcha.
And maybe this can be applied to that. I don't think that we need to stop doing all white Wagners. I mean, maybe less of that. But like
our
the thing is though, we could be balancing the scales more. Like, we could be doing more diverse, accessible things. And I think that that is kind of the... That's the conversation generally when you're talking about social justice. Like, the Black Lives Matter movement, for example. It's not saying Black lives are more important. It's just about saying, like, we are... Like, this is equal. Not equal, but... you know what I mean. Like...
We're trying to bring up a suppressed group of people to the actual level of everybody else.
Exactly.
Instead of raising them up above everybody. But that's what some people translate Black Lives Matter.
Well, yeah, and I think that that's kind of where that guy faltered, is because what he was saying was like...
You're talking about the guy from the San Francisco.
The San Francisco, yeah. The San Francisco Symphony?
Yeah.
Is that he was basically... What he basically ended up saying was, well, it'd be... too hard for us to figure out the best way to reach out to this community that's lower than us in the social strata. So let's just leave them there.
Rather than do something bluesy or something that they can relate to, we gotta find something real. And then it feels like, oh, we're only doing this so you can relate to it. And then it makes us look bad, like we're like...
Do you know what would have been a really good thing for them to do? Reach out to any Black opera singer anywhere, hire them as a consultant, and then have them put on a production they actually want to see. Not just, like, another contrived Porgy and Bess. Oh, yeah.
Yes, but I mean, like, a black conductor.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Well, I mean, like, Grant Park Festival has Project Conclusion. Have you guys heard of that? Mm-hmm. It is a string quartet that they have different people in every year, and it's only for people of color.
But I also think, you know, diversity, you mentioned diversity before, is more than just diversity of color or race.
Absolutely.
It's of age. It's of...
gender.
You know, it's a diverse word.
Right.
It's
like,
that's a bumper sticker, right?
Yeah. You know, it's something that, like, when... diversity and accessibility. These are the two that I'm just... If you keep on saying them, I'm just going to keep on throwing darts back at, like,
yeah.
You know, like... But I think that, like, if you look at the Sinfonietta, right? Mm. They're doing a great work with diversity. Mm-hmm. If you want to follow the Chicago Sinfonietta. Mm-hmm. They're doing great work around the city, like, you know, like, exposing people to new types of music and having it be, like... including everyone, this invitation sort of...
The last concert I sang in the chorus of the Beethoven 9 that they did, and the fact it was about... every year they do a Martin Luther King weekend concert in to honor their founding artistic director. And it's a beautiful event. And they always include so many diversities.
Yeah.
That doesn't even make sense. But, like, throughout, there were... young students who were featured as soloists. They had a young African-American girl speak, like, one who won a poetry competition, speak in between two of the sets. They had all these interactive activities, like, during intermission to talk about, like, what people stand for and all that kind of thing. And it takes energy and effort, but it just feels more complete. It doesn't feel like you're walking in, experiencing something, watching something, and then leaving. Like, it's a full immersion, and it takes energy and resources. And I guess some people want to use art as that kind of escape where they just go in and focus, but that's what Netflix, those kind of things are for nowadays. I feel like live theater and theater in the sense that anything that you really go to see,
you just have to want to do it. I mean, it can be something as simple. I think I've made this known to y'all about the shows I don't like. Traviata is one opera I cannot stand. Mm. But the third time I went, a friend offered me a ticket to The Dress. She goes, "You want to watch it?" I go, "You know what? I'll give it a third shot." And I went there and I didn't like it again. But besides the point, it was the day they had given tickets. The Lyric had given tickets to all the high schools to come watch The Dress.
Mm.
Lots of diverse people there, yeah. And basically the community is mostly Black, Latino. And during one of the breaks, they turn the lights on, open the doors, and I saw a group of teenage girls run out to the lobby, mostly Black and Latino, and then one in the back, one of the girls said, "Oh my God, that was so good, guys!" And all the good girls were like, "Yeah," and they kind of laughed, but the one girl in the back was just enamored by it. And I was like, all it takes is for us to touch one person.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if she's the only one who liked it in a crowd of 3,000 high school, or I don't know how many fits in there, 800 high school students.
Yeah.
We we've made one more fan. And who knows, she's going to go home and Google Traviata and find out about Verdi and find out about Italian opera and go, ooh, what's like, what's also like, oh, there's this other French opera that kind of like, and what, all takes one person. But they, something as simple as, hey, watch a dress rehearsal. And that's all that took. But you're right, like that idea that it, we can touch one person. Outer Bohème last year, I sang it, and you know, we all have our own, we're all self-critical, and I was like, God, I wish I sang that better, I wish I had placed this better, blah, blah, blah. I'm walking down Lakeshore Drive, and this dude's riding his bike, and I was like, this dude's gonna hit me, and he stops, he goes, hey, I go, hey, he goes, didn't you sing Rodolfo last week? And I was like, well, yeah. He goes, yeah, I watched you at the nightcap, that was really, it was so good, I you know, I didn't get to talk to you after the show, and I was just, I was blown away, this guy, this guy like rolled up to me on his bike randomly on Lakeshore, and you touched, that means you touched somebody, like somebody remembered you, like spotted you out of a crowd. And granted, talking about tokenism, I, with the exception of two other Filipinos in town, I am the only other Filipino tenor singing opera here, so you don't have to look very hard to find me if you've seen me in the show. But yeah, this guy rolled me. I thought he was going to run me over. It was the coolest thing, and I was blown away by that. Yeah. But he was like, oh, no, I'd never seen Bohème before. I'd never seen opera that close. And and he goes, and you were just, and I was just like, oh, I mean, keep the compliments coming. But yeah, it was just, it was so cool. Just that, and you touch one person. I could just touch one person.
I completely agree. And the thing I just want to say is that I feel like if you're running an opera company and you don't think that that's important, like if you don't think that just reaching out to one, getting one person involved in opera is important, I don't trust you. That is completely suspect to me, because like that's all that it takes, and like that is the point of art, is entirely is to just try as hard as we can to like get someone to get it, you know, like
we talked last time about talent in the city, right? I think that Chicago's awesome because it gives the opportunity for high quality performances like the one we're going to be doing next week, to be seen by people and to move people at like a low cost, you know, like, and I think that, you know, $50 ticket is a lot, but you're getting a lot for the quality. Like we're getting amazing people to show up to the show.
And just to touch on the reason why you hate Traviata, I think it's the same reason why I don't really like any Strauss operas. It's just like rich white people problems.
Wagner. I'm not a big Wagner fan.
Oh my gosh. But like, that's another thing is the subject matter of these operas that are coming out. And I feel like 20th century opera got a better idea of what to focus on, but then like their music got weird and they lost track of what actually is enjoyable. And so hopefully that nowadays, with the culmination of socially conscious artists, as well as companies, I feel like something's coming. There's some nice juicy pieces coming up for everybody.
Well, I want to ask two things. First off, in this conversation of diversity that we're having, I think it's really interesting, Joaquin, your perspective of I don't think this is that complicated of a question. Do you feel like because you're not white, you have a harder time playing this role?
Yeah, really? Starting off, there were other reasons. The first couple times I sang it, it was with a white woman who's 5'9". So there were two things already involved in that. Like, oh my God, she's like 5 inches taller than me, and she's white. Will they air quote podcast gold? I've been waiting to do that. Will they air quote accept this?
Yeah.
Really, and that's just the first thing. Is like because, and you know, I've been this height since my junior year in high school. I hit 5'4¾", and I've stayed this height the whole time. So I've known how it's been to be this tall at this age. So when they start pairing me up, I'm like, oh wow, they'll never want to set me against a woman who's 5'9". And Brenda said, I don't really give a shit about that. I give a shit about like voices matching, and I have very good chemistry with the Mimi who sang last year. We've been friends for like 3 years, so it wasn't a big deal. They're like, oh, like, we can kind of flirt, it's kind of fun, and we had a very good friendly chemistry that can read off as, oh yeah, we're kind of romantically involved. But that was kind of a thing, and I was like, oh. And then you're thinking, oh, I'm singing a role that white people sing. I mean, I've been told I was asked to audition for a company that wanted to do all Asians in all the butterfly roles, and no Asians got cast in the butterfly roles. They were all covers. Wow. Yeah, and I did it anyway. And then in that same And I people might guess what it is, but in that same show, Japanese baritone's got a beautiful voice. He can sing sharpless in his sleep. She told him, oh, you can't sing sharpless because you're Japanese. And he had to sing the bonsai and Yamadori. He got to do the bones because he was Japanese, but she wouldn't cast him as sharpless, even though he had it, you know, he could do it in his sleep. And in so she goes, oh, you can't do sharpless. And I was like, wait, what a minute. I mean, I was also told I was too short to sing Goro.
What? It's a comic center part, right?
He's Japanese, dude. Like,
yeah.
And so, like,
I'm really glad you brought up all these points, because my original thought was like, there's nothing inherently about you as a person that's like stopping you from singing Rodolfo, like purely. But like, there is so much of, like, it's like so interesting that I like speaking to my own ignorance of like realizing that like so much of like societal influence would affect like how the nuances of like how you would sing it, you know, or like how you would. Does that make sense? Or my,
yeah, it does. Off? I think to answer your original question, the fact that it's a white, I mean, I'm singing in an industry where almost all the roles are white. Yeah. I mean, love Porgy and Bess, and you know my thoughts on that. I can't even sing in that show, and I'm a diverse person. I can't sing in that show. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't even like get cast as a Japanese person in a Japanese show. Like, so yeah. it's all the roles I've, most of the roles I've sung are white, but they don't have to be. They don't have to be a white, yeah, person playing the role. And like, I hung out with lots of Filipinos in undergrad. We were poor as shit, dude. And we lived the exact, mm-hmm, same way. Like, it's not just white people living in the Latin Quarter in France. It's everywhere. It can happen everywhere. So I didn't, yeah, draw upon, oh, do they live in France? No. If you're talking about cultural things like Pruny di Tour, I've never had grapes or what, plums from Tour.
Yeah.
but you know, it's, yeah, that kind of thing where it's really mental. It's just like, okay, I can, you just, they're gonna believe it. I'm gonna make this as believable as we can. If, yeah, she's 5'9", then it was. If she's a white woman, she is. Whatever color, whatever height, that's why I was cast.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make that go.
Also with like the new concepts people are coming out, these realism, like the crazy realism everyone's trying to like marry themselves to. It's not a huge deal right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're 100 years in the future, you know, like we're moving on.
Yeah.
Like, you,
yeah,
don't have, it's to say
a tricky
it.
Thing though with the whole like take Ragtime. Like, you can't cast a white person as Cole House.
Yeah.
Like, that is
but
finito, right?
Yeah.
But opposite way, like say Norm Lewis playing Javert in Stars. Like, That is a white role, but it's great that they're colorblinding that cast. So like,
yeah,
where can you colorblind cast? Where does it mess with people's visual perception too much? Where is it something like Hairspray, where it's a integral part of the plot? Like,
right.
I have such a hard time forming an opinion about that, as well as blackface and like Othello, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because it just seems like there's a bigger question beyond it, and I have a really hard time just like saying one word, especially as, yeah, a white dude. Like, Christ, like, yeah, it's very, very challenging. Because the one thing that I almost felt good to read was there was that whole big thing about the Met not doing blackface with Othello, and about all the different actors, like African American tenors, who could have done it, but they cast a white guy. Mm-hmm. But a lot of them were like, yeah, it's not like, it's not blackface like it was in the early 20th century, mm-hmm, or the late 19th century. Like, it's a makeup, you're performing a show, it's not to ridicule, it's not to, what's the word I'm looking for? It's not a parody.
Mm.
It's just, you're, just like if you were performing somebody old, you would put on an old makeup, and I'm not sure if that's insensitive to say, but it just, a lot of African-American opera singers are like, no, I don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I'd rather have the amazing music performed. You know, like, yeah, I'd rather hear it instead of like not hear it, because you know
you don't have the exact,
because artistic person, directors, yeah, can't get their shit together. You know,
yeah,
like,
yeah,
like I just would I'd rather hear the music.
Yeah,
I'd rather, yeah, hear the amazing score of Porgy and Bess as much, well, as I can. You know, because I love the music. You know,
right, yeah, and I think we just the answer to that is we need to hire more people that are diverse in administrative roles, people that like you know, we need to get to the people that own companies and be like, you guys need to hire more administratively.
I'd say diversified boards. Like, yeah. I think that that's more important than diversifying staff.
Well, the last question, and I have 2 minutes to answer it. We have 2 minutes to answer it.
Okay.
Is I think it's interesting that we have a female director and we're coming at it from the perspective of being four guys doing it, because I've heard a lot of conversations about male versus female directors, and like, and I think it's interesting because I don't think men really, as a director, can like tell a woman the nuances of what it's like for Don Anna to be raped, for example, you know, or like there's a lot of area like that in opera and things like that, where it's like, for male directors, it's like, you, there are some things where you just kind of have to step back, whereas I think with female directors, a lot of times they're able to, I mean, sure, there are a couple things that they maybe don't entirely will 100% understand the nuances of. But the problem, the things that they won't understand is, like, what it's like to pee in a urinal or something. You know what I mean? Like, so, like,
I wouldn't put that past them either. I'm sure. Yeah. I'm sure some people have been desperate and given a shot.
Yeah. Well, and I guess my question is, is that something you guys have, like, is that something you guys have thought about? Or, like, is that, I think, with Emma, for example, like, I think it was, do you think that we've, well, so, like, taking from last year to this year, last year we had a male director, and this year we have a female director, like, is that played into it at all? Or, like,
do you think it's just Emma?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to stick my neck out there and say that I concentrate more on the personality and the experience of the director than the gender.
Yeah.
If there can be a female, like, that's just furthering stereotypes, right? So, like, there can be a female who can be super non-emotional and just, like, really closed off to other people's reactions and situations, while there can be a male director who can be incredibly nuance and really know what it feels like and empathetic towards other right. people. So it doesn't even occur to me whether it's
I think the reason why Emma is such a successful director is because she has brothers and she understands men.
Right. You know, it's the same way a guy who had a lot of sisters would, could.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm uncomfortable saying that's just a gender thing. And I'm not sure if that's insensitive, but like, we're trying to break stereotypes, right? So it's more about who the human is,
yeah,
and what kind of experiences they have and are bringing to the table, and how open they are. Like, that's my checklist. Like, are you open to change? Do you have different perspectives? Do you have a unique perspective? And how is that going to translate to the show? Not like, hey, the dude's directed the show 3 times. Like,
and
we need to check.
And can that dude or whoever communicate effectively with the cast to get the best product for the audience? Because that's the whole thing.
Right.
That's the whole reason you're doing it.
Right.
You know.
No, I completely agree.
I think she can. Yeah, no, I'm just saying, I think she, with the experience, I think it's her personality. It's their personality, too. But I think as this person, a lot different. Like, our director last year was kind of brought in last minute. We kind of directed ourselves. We half-directed ourselves.
And, he kind of bumpered us around.
Yeah. He bumpered us around, but we luckily, I'm surrounded by 3 singers who are very good actors.
Give it a thumbs up.
Yeah, and so I'm not taking away. I really liked our director last year, but we've had the full process with our director this time, and she's taken a different route than our director did last year. And we know her personally. She's not different as a director than she is in real life. Mm-hmm. So we all know Emma Cox personally, and that's the same Emma Cox that shows up as a director.
Yeah,
and it's interesting. It's because some directors will put on the director hat and be like, okay, I'm a director now. And, you know, mm-hmm. and male or man or woman. And then she's just, I'm Emma. I'm wearing my director shirt, but I'm still Emma.
Yeah.
I like the fact that she has great attention to detail. And I also love the fact that she can communicate really well with people.
Yes.
Those are the things I really appreciate in a director.
And I think it's interesting going back to this idea of like working inside of other people's expectations of you. Like when we were talking about race in that way. Like, I'm sure that Emma coming into this project sees 4 dudes that have done the roles before and is like, well, what can give here? And I think like, coming from my perspective of like, I just want Emma to be able to do whatever she wants to see done, you know? And I think you have to do that. And I think that if you're talking about the gender, I really appreciate what you were saying. Because like, Gabe, you. I realized that podcast gold, I pointed directly at you. And then I was like, Gabe. because I think really what it comes down to is playing inside of other people's expectations. And I had another point there, but I'm good. I think we should finish up if you guys are, unless you guys have any other. Well, the last thing we do in every episode is plugs, and I know that you have to run. So if you want, you can go first, and if you need to run right away,
it's okay. Yeah.
Because I still have to do like donate to the show and shit, and I'm not gonna make you stay for that if you don't want to. Yeah. So you, but plugs. So if you, what we do at the end of the show is we do a minute long plug for every guest. So just things you have upcoming. For sometimes it's more obvious, like the show that we're on to talk about, and other times it's like, I really love this TV show I just started watching, or like, you know, I really love this opera company or this performance outlet. They're doing cool things.
Well, I'll put a couple things out there. First of all, this show is awesome, and if you've not gone to it last year, you should go to it this year, mostly because it is a very unique, incredible Bohème.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, if you're going to experience Bohème, experience it like this, because you'll understand it, and you'll be able to, like, go home and tell people about it. Secondly, Perfect Americans at Chicago Opera Theater, and Perfect American is a really cool opera about the last days of Walt Disney. Philip Glass is going to be there.
Fictionalized, right?
Fictionalized, yeah. And really, really cool set elements. Last thing is War and Peace, Floating Opera, is doing War and Peace next month. And we have officially confirmed that Robert Sims is going to be performing with us on that. Which is me too. And Gabe. and Joaquin.
Yeah.
It's Robert Sims, incredible lyric baritone, is going to be our featured soloist for that. Chicago Temple, May 28th and 29th.
Memorial Day weekend.
Projections. Composite opera.
Yeah, we wrote this. So
it'll be really cool.
Yep.
Yeah.
Twitter at Joaquin Luis. You'll see my spelling on the Scopy website. Facebook, same thing. Let's see. I will be doing the Bohème April 21st, 22nd, 23rd, Nightcap Cafe. If we didn't already say, with us, we have Justino Carano as Alcindor Benoit. We have Andrea Jones as Musetta, and Sladjana Jadic. Ooh.
I just know her first name.
Yana. Oh, that's embarrassing. Sorry, Yana.
She's fantastic, though. Love you. She's very talented.
For Mimi. We also have... I will be in War and Peace with Floating Opera Company. And then something I'm really excited for. In June, I will be going off to Boston to do another production of Noli Me Tangere, which is an opera in Tagalog or the Filipino language with Opera Britannica and a collaboration of Birmingham Opera, which will start off a national tour within the next year. So I'm super excited about that.
Yeah, that's cool.
Thank you.
Cool. So y'all took my thunder for that, so I'll do something different. I'm in Lucrezia, which is a William Bolcom one act with Chicago Fringe Opera.
Yay.
That's going to be May 6th, with 9th, 11th, and 13th.
Maestro nice. Kathy O'Shaughnessy.
We are a package pair right now going to the next show. Directed by George Cedarquist. It's fantastic. Some other singers are Ashley Armstrong, Diana Stoic, Toby Wright, Matthew Black. And Kathy, like I said, is music director. Brad Caleb Lee is production design. That's at the Chopin Theater or the Chopin Theater. I'm not sure how they say it. Mm-hmm. But it's cool. We're going to do the first half is going to be open. The bar is going to be open, and it's going to be all Bolcom art song.
Cool.
And so it'll be very interactive there. And then we'll take a break and do the 50-minute one act opera, which is pretty hysterical.
Cool.
A lot of sex. A lot of rock and roll.
Oh, I'm there.
When is it again?
It is May 6th, 9th, 11th, and 13th at the Chopin Theater.
Yeah, and they're all very busy men. So there's a lot of things. If you want to rewind back, I highly recommend it to catch all the details they're in.
May I add real quick? Sladjana Sadic.
Nice.
And Opera Ouvert, the artistic director and founder is Brenda Turner.
Nice. Yes, ma'am. Cool. Well, thank you all so much for listening. I've been Daniel Johansson. If you want to keep up with Scopy Mag, there are plenty of ways that you can do that. You can head over to our website, scopymag.com. There are articles there. There's our entire list of podcasts. We are currently looking for more article writers. If you're interested in doing that, send us an email, scopymag@gmail.com, with a story pitch, a resume. We are looking for AP writing. If you don't know AP, I can send you a PowerPoint about it and edit your work. We are also on Facebook under Scopy Magazine. You can we do photo essays up there sometimes, and we post all of our podcast episodes up on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Scopy Mag. I'm going to do Maureen's bit because she's not here about donations. We are running on a very small budget. We have a budget, which is very exciting, and it's only because of our donors. So if you want to donate, we'd really appreciate it. You can donate for a monthly amount, or you can donate for one time. If you donate monthly, we'll send you... we'll thank you on the show. And if you donate one time, we'll send you a thank you note in the mail. If you want to donate, there's a lot of ways to do that. We've made it very easy. Maureen has put donate links on the website, scoppymag.com, on every page, in every corner. It will find you if you are looking for it.
That's like the IRS.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. We very much need donations. We have a lot of projects upcoming, and they all cost money. So please help. great. And thank you all so much for listening. Go out and make something.
Yes. Bye.